I'm Danny Alexander, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Our favorite songs, they seem so personal. They perk us up and help us wallow in heartbreak. They are the soundtrack of our lives. Nothing can transport you back to a favorite summer break quite like hearing one of the popular tunes of that year. So yes, hit songs may seem like they were written just for us, but they each have a story all their own. Today we look behind the lyrics and turn the melodies inside out to discover the origin of our favorite songs. We'll dissect hits from Southern Rock, Black Power, Pop, and Country Western. Join us as we examine the anatomy of songs. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. You know, when you're playing music as a backdrop to what you're doing, you know, driving, working around the house, then a tune comes on that suddenly grabs you. It could be a classic. It could be the latest alt indie making its way up the charts. Either way, the next thing you know, you're singing along, maybe doing a little chair dancing in your car. What is it about those songs that make us forget ourselves for the moment and get lost in a combination of melody and lyrics? That's something that Mark Myers has spent some time dissecting. He's a Wall Street Journal music columnist and author of Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. He also writes the daily music blog, jazzwax.com. Mark is back with us to talk about a few more of those hits and reveal what's made them as memorable as they are. He's in the studios of NPR in New York City. Hello, Mark.
Danny, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. So what does it take for a song to become iconic? Is it music, lyrics, the singer, the time it represents? Are there common denominators to these songs?
Yeah, I think it's two things, Danny. I think it's an important message. In other words, the song needs to be conveying something that's cultural or political or social. Mm-hmm. And it's also about whether the song makes us feel the same way over time. If you feel the same way when you hear Let It Be or The Stones, Satisfaction, if you feel the same way you did when you first heard it, it has legs.
So it's a lot to do with what it evokes in the individual listener.
Correct. If it holds up over time as a valuable song and message.
Okay. Well, let's start with a theme in music, and that theme is sticking with the one you love. And perhaps no one said it better than the remarkable Tammy Wynette in "Stand By Your Man."
Sometimes it's hard to be a woman, give him all your love to just one man. You'll have bad times, and he'll have good times, doing things that you don't understand. But if you love him, you'll forgive him, even though he's hard to understand. And if you love him, I'll be proud of him, 'cause after all, he's just a man. Stand by your man, give him two arms to cling to, and something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely.
Stand by your man. So when this came out in 1968, she already had several hits under her belt, but this one stood out. How'd that song come about?
Our producer, Tammy's producer, Billy Sherrill, the legendary producer in Nashville, he had a folded paper in his wallet. He had this idea in his head, this line that he had for some time, and he opened it up, and it was, "I'll Stand By You." And they needed a song, and he reworked the lyric that he had. He reworked those lyrics so that they would come from the perspective of a woman talking to another woman about a guy.
And I'm thinking a lot of women still, when they hear those opening lines, go, "Yep, I hear you, sister."
You're right.
Well, she the one thing is, Wynette really shows what she can do with her voice here, doesn't she? I mean, she goes from soft and vulnerable to, and then she hits that chorus, and it's like, boom.
Yeah, it's this restrained, it's almost like a muscle car idling, right?
Yes,
and all
there
of a sudden
you
it just shifts, you know, double clutches and just roars off out of the Dairy Queen or something. I mean, there, she's got enormous power, but she's halting and somewhat vulnerable in the verses. And then with the chorus, it's just she opens it up all the way.
Yeah, showing her conviction, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But there's some irony here. In Tammy's personal life, she stood by a number of men, having been married five times. I mean, the great country western star George Jones was number three in that lineup, and their professional association lasted longer than the marriage. How good were they as a singing duet?
Oh, they were great. I mean, you know, together, they had 14 country hits. Three of them were number ones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was this combination of George Jones's, you know, countrypolitan cool, which was really what Nashville was about, was really hitting its stride then. And George Jones, you know, he's just delivering those cool, cool lines. And Tammy's, there's a heat to her. There's a heat. So that sound together was remarkable.
A good foil, one for the other. And Jones would have four wives in his life. And in 1966, as his second marriage was winding down, he released "I Don't Love You Anymore," which isn't as harsh as it may sound. Let's take a listen.
"I don't love you anymore like the way I did before. And since you found somebody new, I think it's best. I don't try and walk the floor. I don't love you anymore. Trouble is, I don't love you any less."
And George wasn't always an easy man to live with. He had his struggles, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, emotionally, on a personal level, you know, George wasn't very accessible emotionally. Alcoholism had a lot to do with it during his marriage to Tammy. But, you know, keep in mind, this was the sound. I mean, we think of the Beatles, the Stones, the Byrds as the sound of the 1960s Cultural Revolution. George Jones is the sound of Nashville. This is the sound of country in the 1960s. He had more than 150 hits.
Oh, God, he was prolific. We're looking at the anatomy of some of the most iconic songs in popular music with Mark Myers, author of Anatomy of a Song, which is now out in paperback. Now, Tammy wasn't the first to hit on this idea of loyalty. In 1961, another singer in a different genre was making a plea. Here's Benny King and one of the most recognizable bass lines in popular music.
"When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Stand by me. If the sky..."
I cannot imagine what that song would have been like without that opening bass, can you?
No, I mean, that's the genius of Mike Stoller, of Lieber and Stoller, the producers of this song. You know, that not only has it, what they've done there is Mike combined a rhythm and blues hook bass line, right?
Right.
And then what you also have is a subtle Latin feel. You've got that guyuro, that scraping, shk, shk. So you've got this Spanish Harlem feel plus the rhythm and blues feel. And it's, again, another standby song like Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man, Stand By Me, another hit.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm chair dancing. Give me a moment. but yeah, I mean, and there's one of those songs that the minute you hear it, like you said in the opening, it's that emotion that it evokes in you, and that's what it just sticks, and that's one of those. But let's stick with country for just another minute here. Hank Williams sings what I think of as a lament about being a rambling man. Let's listen to a few bars of that.
I can settle down and be doing just fine till I hear an old freight rolling down the line. Then I hurry straight home and pack. And if I didn't go, I believe I'd blow my stack. I love you, baby, but you gotta understand, when the Lord made me, he made a rambling man.
And Mark, that was done in 1951?
Yeah, and you know, Hank Williams Sr. there, it's got the lumbering sound of a hobo. It's the clickety-clack of a hobo train, right? But it's also haunting. There's a doomed feel, like things are never going to go well. He is who he is, a rambling man, but it's just a world of loneliness.
And that voice, when it goes up, when he, like what I think of as, breaks up into that higher note.
Yodeling, yeah.
Yeah, that slight yodel to it just really gives it that train whistle
Chills.
Effect. Yeah,
definitely.
So let's jump ahead to 1973 and another song, same title, inspired by Hank Williams, the Hank Williams tune. It's released by the Allman Brothers Band, and that symbol of Southern rock. The songwriter was Dickie Betts, who also played guitar in the band. Tell us a little more what was behind this song, and then we'll take a listen.
Dickie Betts wrote it because his father was in construction in Florida, and he shuttled between the two coasts of Florida, constantly working back and forth and taking Dickie with him. And as a result, Dickie used to stay at friends' houses if he wanted to stay in school in one side of the state, and then he'd have to go to another and have other friends over there. And one day one next-door neighbor said, you're quite a rambling man. And that idea stuck in his head. So when he sat down in 1972 in the Macon Big House where the Allman Brothers all lived together, he started to write this song. And he kept it in his back pocket, and then suddenly they needed it in 1973.
Well, let's take a listen to what they ended up playing in 1973.
Lord, I was born a rambling man, trying to make a living and doing the best I can. And when it's time for leaving, I hope you'll understand. I was born a rambling man. My father was a gambler down in Georgia, and he wound up on the wrong end of a gun. And I was born in the backseat of a Greyhound bus, rolling down Highway 41. Lord,
I wanted to play a little bit of that solo because Betts also cited Eric Clapton as an inspiration for this. So what Clapton song in particular, and what about it did Betts like?
Well, when Betts says, well, all right, at that moment there, that's Layla. Layla had come out a year earlier, and Dickie loved that song, loved the power of it, loved the rambling quality of it, and just wanted to work it in somehow because he felt it really would have import.
And so listeners understand, here's a little bit of Eric Clapton playing Layla. And I'm assuming that's part of what inspired him. There was also, wasn't there a solo at the end or a bit of a jam at the end of this song as well?
Yeah, which harkens to Layla as well. I mean, there is this sound there where you've got two guitars going at it, but the thing is that this sound that he hears is, it's like a clarion call, right,
mm-hmm.
Danny? It's just like, you
mm-hmm.
know, this fanfare, the way that busts out. And that's true of both songs.
Very true. And I will let you know that all three of us here in the studio, my producer and my board engineer, we were all dancing. And I'm thinking, yeah, song like this too, though, I'm thinking air guitarists must love it.
Yeah, you can almost hear the ding, ding, ding of the pinball machine in some bar where they're pulling long necks out of ice.
I love the pictures you paint. You know what? Let's step away for a moment. And when we come back, we'll visit the music of the Staple Singers, the Young Rascals, and Steely Dan. I'm Danny Alexander, and this is Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Danny Alexander, sitting in for Steve Kraske. Gold Star parent Keza Khan rebuked candidate Donald Trump during last year's Democratic convention. He had a great conversation with Steve Kraske about the American ideals that first attracted him to this country. And you can find that conversation and others at kcur.org. With the polling errors of 2016 in mind, Steve is back tomorrow to talk about the value of political surveys and polling. That's tomorrow's Up to Date. But this morning, Mark Myers is our guest today. He is the author of The Oral Anatomy of a Song, The Oral History of 45 Iconic Hits That Changed Rock, R&B, and Pop. It's now out in paperback. Glad to say that we have the hard copy. We've it's getting a little dog-eared. We've been going through it so much. So let's swing and do a little change here. The Staple Singers, they first gained fame as a gospel group. They never abandoned their church roots, even when they came to Stack Records in Memphis. But a producer there, Al Bell, had just the song to, as he said, inch them away from strict gospel. What was that song, Mark?
Respect Yourself.
And the only song on the entire list of what songs we were doing today that I really could not recall when I saw the title.
Oh, but once you hear once you hear Mavis, I mean, it just you know it right away. Even if you don't know it, you know it. I mean, it's just got such a great translation quality to it.
And as I was reading your description of it with the interviews that you did, it was like Pop Staple wasn't so sure about this.
Well, it had sort of a layman's, you know, sexiness to it that, you know, they were church people. They were mm-hmm. church singers. And he was always very mindful that, you know, he wanted to move into the mainstream. But what was always holding him back a little bit was this fear that they'd sound a little too, that the Lord wouldn't quite like what they were singing. So he had to be careful. So it was a little bit of a fine line on this dee, 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 dee. As he told Mac Rice, the writer, Mac, this isn't us. We can't sing stuff like that. And Mac said, oh, no, all the kids are doing this. You know, have the kids, you know, have Mavis, have Yvonne, have Cleo sing this. It'll be good. It'll be good.
And what they really balanced it with was respectful lyrics, too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the lyrics themselves really is about, you know, stop. It was really a self-cultural, you know, it was to the African-American community at that point, the young community, saying, stop dissing yourself. Stop. You know, stop with the drugs, stop being rude to women, stop all this stuff, you know, respect yourself more, you know, be a respectful person, be a good person.
Shall we play a little bit of Respect Yourself?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, here are the Staple Singers.
I know what.
nowadays we think, oh, DDD, da da da, no big deal. But it's kind of hard to imagine why Pop Staples was so concerned about that.
It was a little risque for them, you know. They were always afraid the church was going to crack down on them, that the church was going to go anti-Staple Singers. So they were always a little mindful. But I think probably because if the mainstream thing didn't work out, they were going to have to go tour churches again to make a living. You don't really want to.
You don't want to burn that bridge. Yeah.
You don't want to do that.
This came out in 1971 and shows how music can reflect the times. What was the cultural atmosphere then?
Oh, it was hot. I mean, you know, I was a kid then. I mean, Martin Luther King had been assassinated in 68. The Black Power movement was on the rise. Mm-hmm. There was this rising anger and tension. You had the Weathermen. I mean, it was a radical, radical time. Increased use of drugs, crime, and the inner cities were just crumbling. There was no upgrade to the cities whatsoever. Everything had moved to the suburbs.
And Respect Yourself followed a line of songs that stressed Black Power. We're going to run through a couple of them. James Brown, and we always think of him as the godfather of soul, but he put a funk beat to the call and response of Say It Loud in 1968. Did a lot of black artists do this, stay within their style of music, but focus the message more on the Black Power message?
Yeah, and it's also less about Black Power, really. It's more about self-respect and pride. Pride being the optimum word there. It's, you know, have dignity.
Well, let's hear a little bit of James Brown with Say It Loud.
Put your bad self, say it loud. Say it loud. Look here. Some people say we got a lot of malice. Some say it's a lot of nerve. But I say we won't quit moving until we get what we deserve. We've been buked and we've been scorned. We've been being bad talked about as sure as you born. As it takes two eyes to make a pair. Brother, we can't quit until we get our share. Say it loud. Say it loud. One more time.
So, I mean, he was saying, you know, we need to get out there and we need to get what's ours. And how did a song like this go over? I mean, was it
was a big hit. Let me climb down off my chair because I was jumping up and down on the chair as the song was going on. It was a huge, huge hit, and it resonated. You know, it really resonated with the African-American community. Think about how radical this is. I mean, this is a big pop hit, and he's basically saying, you know, be proud of who you are, say it loud. You know, mm-hmm. Be proud of it, say it loud. And this also ties in, by the way, to, you know, Muhammad Ali and the champion he was as an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a very, very big, big time for that.
Well, in 69, Sly and the Family Stone came out with Stand. Would it be fair to call that an anthem?
Yeah, I mean, it's an anthem for standing up for yourself. And the point being that, you know, in the end, you're all you've got.
And they did it in as only Sly and the Family Stone can do it. Here's a bit of Stand. And then the year before, the Staples came out with Respect Yourself, and there's additional news that just came out this morning. The musician and civil rights activist Nina Simone, who just was announced into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, came out with To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. Let's first take a listen to that, and then we'll come back and chat about it real quickly. So this is Nina Simone, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black.
Open your heart to what I mean.
Now, to me, that had a feel of gospel to it, which was a strong part of Simone's background, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the lyrics there are by Weldon Irvine, which were in memory of Simone's friend, Lorraine Hansberry, who's, of course, the author of Raisin in the Sun, who had died in 1965. But, you know, what a concept. I mean, that blacks weren't just equal, but you could be gifted and exceptional. You know, that was a concept really introduced by this song. It's one thing to demand pride or demand equality, but to be young, gifted, and black, I mean, it makes you tingle. It's a concept introduced there, and if one is African-American, that just, I can only imagine how that would light you up
and
at that time
I was going to say, and it's still as powerful today, I'd say.
Yeah.
Well, the late 60s, early 70s had so much going on culturally. While black power was making itself known, you also had the flower power thing going on, that laid-back feel coming out of San Francisco. You want a carefree song? Here you go, the Young Rascals and their 1967 hit, Groovin'.
Groovin' on a Sunday afternoon.
I had to let that whole song play.
Yeah, I hear you.
I can still sing it from beginning to end. And thank God I only do that in the shower and the car.
Uh-huh.
But this is what, you know, this had that feel, that real flower power feel to it. But these guys were from, I mean, I grew up in Long Island. These guys were from Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Jersey boys.
Yeah, Jersey boys. The inspiration, though, was something anyone can understand. Tell us the story on what inspired this song.
Felix Cavallari, the leader of the Rascals, wrote this for a girlfriend who became his muse.
Always the greatest inspiration, aren't they?
It really is. And her name was Adrienne. Adrienne, really. I mean, I guess I pronounce it. But it's about a perfect Sunday. And, you know, two interesting things. This song almost never came out. Atlantic Records didn't want to release it. Jerry Wexler did not want to release this song. He felt it was too Latin. He felt that Latin beat was working against it. And what Murray the K got ticked off. Murray the K was the big New York disc jockey, the fifth Beatle, right? He stormed into Jerry Wexler's office and says, "If you have to release this song, and what I'll do is I'll play this every hour on the hour. You'll make your money back. You've got to release it." So if it wasn't for Murray the K, it wouldn't have been released. And one more little thing, I always thought as a kid he was saying "you and me and Leslie," right? Okay.
I never heard that. I always heard you and me endlessly.
See, okay, but I'm from New York. It always sounded like "you and me and Leslie." As a kid, I never understood. Like, I guess it's a perfect day, but isn't one girlfriend enough? I mean, what do you need? Why is Leslie tagging along? But it, you know, when I asked him, he said, "No, that was you and me endlessly." Right.
Goodness gracious. So Groovin' had a Latin influence. 4 years earlier, singer Jimmy Saboteur with the Joe Cuba Sextet came out with their own song about being with your girl. A little more romantic, would you say?
This is the Latin influence, right? When I say that, you know, this had a Latin influence, Felix loved Latin music. These guys were always in New York. Felix was living in New York. Spanish Harlem and the Boogaloo was a big influence. Mm-hmm. And the early 60s, you know, between 62 and about 66, 67, Latin Boogaloo dance music was very, very hot. And this is one of the influences that Felix had in mind when he wrote this song.
It amazes me that they had to have a champion like Murray the K, and there's a sidebar there too, but to actually get that little bit of Latin influence into Groovin'.
Atlantic did not want to go there. You know, they just didn't want the Latin thing. They just felt like it was just not, it was crossing over too much and it wouldn't be a mainstream hit. It wouldn't maximize the chart.
And another thing that shows is, and that you really, I don't think you see today, is the power of the DJs in those days.
DJs? Yeah, what are those today, right?
Yeah, but your career could rise and fall on a DJ liking or not liking your
completely,
song.
Completely.
And Murray the K was a classic. I grew up listening to Murray the K. I love that guy.
Yeah, that
so,
hat.
So let's listen to Be With You. This is Jimmy Saboteur with the Joe Cuba Sextet.
Yeah, Joe Cuba Sextet.
Cuba Sextet. Yeah. And you'll get a sense of where they got that Latin from. Now, was Jimmy and that sextet, were they basically local to New York? I mean, did they really, outside of the regional market, did they have much of an audience?
No, they came from Puerto Rico. Their families were from Puerto Rico, and this is the early part of, you know, the Boogaloo. This isn't a Boogaloo, obviously. It's not a dance number, but it is this intensely humid, romantic love song. And all you can think of, I mean, the word that comes to mind for me is bliss. I mean, you really feel the bliss of love when you hear Jimmy Saboteur sing that
because
thing.
Because it's so smooth.
Yeah, it's just takes you away, but this is what Felix is responding to, and that's what you hear in Groovin'.
So was Groovin' maybe one of the earlier examples of where they started to bring in a little more of a different influence, and did others try it after then?
Yeah, I mean, you hear it in Grazin' in the Grass, right?
Oh, yeah.
You hear the Latin thing. The Latin thing creeps into pop music. Look at Light My Fire, Jose Feliciano's cover of the Doors song. You know, that's Latin romantic also. He's treating it completely different, and many people like it better than the Doors version.
Yeah, well, we won't tell the Doors then. finally today, I've saved a big chunk of time here because 7 minutes and 34 seconds of music that its co-writer says is a, and I'm quoting here, about a broken dream of a broken man living a broken life. What song are we talking about here, Mark?
Deacon Blues, one of my favorites.
Yes.
By Steely Dan in 1977.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I know.
Horns played a big part here. Fagan and Becker, by this time, were handpicking musicians. They had an idea of the sound they wanted. What example were they using?
These guys were jazz heads. I mean, they really loved jazz. They listened to jazz. They understood R&B, and they understood Ray Charles, and they understood where that music needed to be. But they loved, John L. Fagan loved, he told me he loved Oliver Nelson, the arranger, and how tightly Oliver Nelson could arrange jazz saxophones, you know, pressed, as he described it, pressed together. And you can hear this. You can hear this in some jazz songs that Oliver Nelson arranged.
And we're going to hear one right now, Oliver Nelson. So they listen to this.
That is the introduction, by the way, to Deacon Blues. That is the specific that is the influence for the introduction to Deacon Blues. So hold that. Listeners should hold that in their heads so
okay.
they can hear the similarity.
So I'm going to start, and we will go ahead right into that, because they certainly got a winner with this one. So from 1977, here is Steely Dan's Deacon's Blues.
Seems like only yesterday I gazed through the glare.
And we're going to let this play because, Steely Dan, and basically it was two guys, they spent a lot of time mixing in the studio, didn't they? They really were very precise in what they wanted and how they were going to get it.
The studio for Donald and Walter was a lab of perfection. They struggled. They would go through 25, 30 musicians to find just the right guitar sound or just the right saxophone sound. And then they basically were looking for the guy that could produce the sound they heard in their heads.
And in this case, one of the saxophonists, they were like, wait, that guy that plays
on the Tonight Show.
It took him a bit, but they actually tracked him down.
Pete Gottlieb, yeah. They tracked him down. They found him, and he came in. When I interviewed him, he said, he was sort of oblivious to Steely Dan, really. He's a jazz guy and a studio guy in L.A. He says, I came in and played the solo twice, and I was out of there in about 15 minutes. And these guys were like, oh, what a solo. This is incredible. It's exactly what we were looking for. What Pete didn't know is there were probably about 20 saxophonists who had come in before him that tried to come up with the right solo but never could.
It's really amazing. This was off the album Aja, correct?
Aja, correct.
Aja. And was that their biggest album?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
Aja and Gaucho are probably their biggest sellers.
Because they really did not create music for the mass market. They basically created what they wanted.
Yeah, they just...
More for the market.
They made their money, and then they just plowed it all back into recording, and then in their case, it was very expensive because of the studio work. They just didn't give a darn. They were making their music their way, the way they wanted it, and if you liked it, great, and if you didn't, I mean, Ricky Don't Lose That Number.
Duh.
I mean, there's so many great songs by Steely Dan, right?
That's
Showbiz
true.
Kids.
Yeah.
We're
probably going to listen to a couple more minutes of this as we go out. Mark, I can't thank you enough for taking the time today. It's been just a wonderful trip for me.
It's been our
pleasure.
It always is.
Mark Myers is the author of Anatomy of a Song, the oral history of 45 iconic hits that changed rock, rhythm and blues and pop, now available in paperback. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Mark, best to you. I'm sure we'll be having you back on anytime we're doing music.
Happy holidays, Danny.
Thank you, and to you as well. And as we listen to the rest of Deacon Blues for a little bit, right coming up next will be Bill Branley and this week's Local Listen. It's Wednesday, so I get to do more music, yay, which means KCR contributor Bill Branley is back with this week's Local Listen. Heidi ho, Bill.
Hi there. I'm so pleased to be part of Jazz Blogger Day and up to date.
Well, I'm just glad that you and I actually get a chance to talk on air. So what's on tap this week for the Local Listen?
Tonight at Helzberg Hall at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra performs its annual Christmas concert. So I brought in a track from the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra's 2012 album with Kevin Mahogany that's a seasonal offering,
mm-hmm.
and I've selected an instrumental mm-hmm. without Kevin, the orchestra's version of Sleigh Ride.
Okay, well, tell you what, let's get that started, take a little listen, and then we'll come back and see what we think of the Christmas music. So this is sure to get some of our listeners in the merry mood. What do you like about this song, Bill?
Well, so much holiday music, Danny, is cloying and overly sentimental. This isn't that. you know, this is buoyant. It's, you know, the musicianship is outstanding.
It's sharp. It's really sharp.
And it just feels good.
It does.
This is something you could actually listen to in July without
you could actually
becoming upset.
Because it's got enough jazzy swing to it. Yeah. I mean, this is something I'd be, as we were talking a second ago, I would easily, while I'm baking the cookies, wrapping the gifts, I'd have this album on in a heartbeat. Are you a fan of Christmas music, though, as a general rule?
No.
Okay. I grew up singing it because I was in choir for so many years, so I still love Christmas tunes. Kansas City Jazz Orchestra was founded in 2003, and you say they were being led by Carrie Strayer when this track was released in 2012, right?
Right. Carrie Strayer was the second director of the orchestra, and he passed away prematurely. He had, prostate cancer issues. So this track, has Carrie's stamp on it. But the orchestra now is directed by one of Kansas City's leading young jazz musicians, Clint Ashlock.
So when you say Strayer's stamp on it?
Well, anyone who attended the Plaza lighting ceremonies on Thanksgiving in the 90s would have heard Carrie Strayer leading a jazz group. Those nights sounded a lot like this.
Okay. The buoyant, the clean.
Yeah, but sort of, as we can hear here, it kind of sounds like George Benson, maybe, the George Benson hit breezing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Carrie had that pop instinct in addition to being an outstanding straight-ahead baritone saxophonist. But Clint has an entirely different style. And so tonight at Helzberg Hall, it'll sound less like this and more like the straight-ahead Count Basie bands that Kansas City is famous for.
But it's all holiday-themed.
It's all holiday-themed. Tonight's show has 10 tracks from the Vince Guaraldi Trio album,
yeah. Okay.
The Charlie Brown Christmas, from the 1965 television special.
And you mentioned before the current artistic director and conductor, Clint Ashlock. He's going to hold a jazz talk before the show. What do you expect from something like that?
Yeah, Clint is very smart, very intelligent, so he'll have interesting things to say about Vince Guaraldi and about the Kansas City jazz scene at 6 o'clock, an hour before the concert tonight.
Oh, so it's in advance, not after.
Right, it's a pre-show talk.
Got it. Okay, so that starts at?
That starts at 6,
and the concert's at 7. Okay.
So you can go to the show and be home in plenty of time to get up tomorrow morning for work.
Okay, I'll remember that. That's KCR contributor Bill Brownlee. Thanks, Bill, as always.
Thanks, Danny.
Download our podcast and listen to previous programs at kcur.org/uptodate. Find us on Twitter. We're at @KCRUptodate. And don't forget, follow KCR on Facebook. Political polling and surveys didn't come away looking all that good after the 2016 presidential race. So on tomorrow's program, we'll see if they still have value when Steve talks with prominent pollster Neil Newhouse. Our program is produced by Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. I'm Danny Alexander, and you are up to date.